So I wanted to start with a question, and the question is, what criteria do we use to choose our religion? So here we are, we've got unprecedented freedom of thought, we've got our own freedom to choose our spiritual path, and we don't have to take on what our parents did, we don't have to take on the religion that our parents conform to, we're free. And we've got so much information, more information than anyone at any time has ever had. So how do we choose in this wealth of information? How do we choose? Which path do we choose? And do we even think about what criteria we're using to choose that path? Well, this was the question that was facing a man called Dr. Ambedkar. So Dr. Ambedkar had a problem. He had a problem which was untouchability, and this was a deep, deep problem, a burning issue that he had to solve. So Dr. Ambedkar was born in India in 1891, and he was born into a caste which is known as untouchable, was known as untouchable. So Hindu society is divided into castes. You may or may not know this. So you've got the Brahmins, the priestly caste at the top, and the Shudras, or labouring caste at the bottom, and all sorts of others with all sorts of subdivisions in between. But the untouchables are even lower than the Shudras, and in a sense they're completely outside the caste system. They're so lower, they're even lower than the lowest, if you see what I mean. And they're called untouchables because any contact with them pollutes the so-called caste Hindus. Even their shadow would pollute a so-called caste Hindu. So it's a system of what Dr. Ambedkar called graded inequality. And castes are fixed. Having been born into a particular caste, you can't get out of it. There's no means to get out of it. And it's often regarded as deeply wrong to even try. So your caste determines your job, who you can marry, who you're friends with, even traditionally where you can walk, where you can get your water, where you can get an education, whether you can get an education at all, sorry, whether you can own land at all, whether you can go to the temple, what you can eat, where you can sit. It governs every single aspect of your life. So it's a system of deep, deep institutionalised inequality. It's unfair, it's untrue, it's one of the kind of worst societal structures you could imagine. And Dr. Ambedkar himself was born into this caste. Incidentally, we don't call people either untouchables or ex-untouchables anymore because, in a way, it's a big lie. It's just a kind of fabrication. So it's not that anyone's untouchable. People prefer to be called Dalits, which means suppressed, because, of course, they're not untouchable, but they've been suppressed by the higher castes. So it's good to know that if you're going to India on a pilgrimage next year. Anyway, Dr. Ambedkar, by a combination of unique historical circumstances, he became the most educated man in India. So this was partly due to the fact that his father, one of the ways you could get out of some of the sort of nastiest caste oppression was you could join the British Army. So the British did one thing right. Eventually they succumbed to pressure from the Brahmins and then they stopped employing untouchables. But for a while they did one thing right. And so his father joined the British Army, his father got an education and he encouraged an education in his son. In fact, he got him up at 2 o'clock in the morning to study for his exams. Can you imagine a teenager in this culture getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to study for their exams? They wouldn't have gone to bed. Anyway, so he through great determination and a lot of support and encouragement from his father, got an MA and PhD in economics at Columbia University. He got an MA and a PhD in economics at the LSE. He became a barrister at Law and Gray's Inn in London. So he was a highly, highly educated man. He could have settled down. He could have settled down and lived a very comfortable life in any country. He could have settled down in the UK. He could have settled down in America. He could have settled down in India. But he had this deep burning question, this issue that he had to solve. And that issue was a quest to end untouchability. So he tried every means he could. He tried political, economic and social strategies to end untouchability, but also to drag India into the modern independent age. So I'll give you a few examples. He tried social action called the Chowder Tank incident. So Dalits were not allowed to take water from the communal tank. Tank means reservoir. So they couldn't share the same water as any caste Hindus. But in 1927, the local municipality opened up the water supply to the Dalit people. Only there was huge resistance from the caste Hindus. They wouldn't let the Dalits drink from that source. So Dr. Ambedkar led 3,000 Dalits to the tank to drink. So that's all they were going to do. They were going to go to the tank and just drink. Just human beings going to the local collective water source. It was simple enough, but of course it was totally revolutionary. And there was a very violent response from the higher caste Hindus, because as far as they were concerned, their water had been polluted by the untouchables. So how were they to purify the water? Well, their method of purification was to add 108 pots of yogurt, milk, cow dung and cow urine to the water supply. How bizarre is that? So Dr. Ambedkar was deeply upset by this, and he tried economic actions. He over the years, he wrote a lot of papers. He criticised the British government for impoverishing India through fiscal methods, because he said that they were running India on the basis of the British manufacturing industry's interests. So he tried sort of economic action, really criticising the British government in particular. And that, again, came to nothing. So he tried political action. So Dr. Ambedkar was chair of the board that drafted the Constitution of India in India's independence. And he drafted that Constitution of India based on Dharmic principles. So it is this wonderful constitution. India's constitution is one of the most enlightened, forward-thinking, liberal constitutions in the world. And he became law minister of the first government of independent India. And what he did then was he tried to bring through Parliament something called the Hindu Code Bill to change some of the more oppressive aspects of Hindu law, particularly in relation to women and women's rights. And again, he was met with serious opposition. So here he was, he'd created this wonderful constitution. He'd written this wonderful, free-thinking, forward-thinking constitution. And he tried to bring in a law that would outlaw some really, really oppressive and, I would say, nasty aspects of Indian society. And they just wouldn't change. He was met with an absolute block. And this precipitated in him a deep internal crisis. He said that he'd created something wonderful in the Constitution of India, but it was like a palace on a dung heap. And the dung heap was the attitude in India of caste and treatment of women. And he saw that it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to create social, economic, or political change. He needed something more. So he said that history bears out the proposition that political revolutions have always been preceded by social and religious revolutions. The emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of a people. The emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of a people. So this is what he realised society needed. Society needs a change of mind and soul. And I've been thinking about what he meant by that. I've been reading around Dr. Ambedkar's teachings, because I think Dr. Ambedkar is much more important than just India. I think he was such an incredible thinker, so forward thinking. And what he's got to say is of use to all of us, not just India. He's a true hero, Dr. Ambedkar, a real hero. And I've been thinking about what he meant by that. What does he mean by mind and soul? You know, the way he uses language is, what would he mean by that? And I think what I've come to the conclusion is that what he meant is that we need a change in myth. Myth in the sense of underlying each of us and each society is a story that makes sense of our lives. That's how Subhuti describes myth, a story that makes sense of our lives, both individually and collectively. There's a kind of deep psychic force that governs the way that we behave. There's a story underneath there that shapes who we are and what form our society takes. And it's that that's really important. So Indian society was founded on a myth. It was founded on a story that Brahma, who's a kind of creator god, created a divided humanity according to their past deeds. So apparently you're born into the caste that you're in because of your past deeds. And the only way out of caste was to perform your caste duty. And then you'll be reborn. If you perform your caste duty in this life, you'll be reborn in a higher caste in the next life. But we shouldn't confuse caste duty with ethics. Caste duty is a sort of series of rules and regulations about what each caste can do and what being in your caste dictates what you can do. So, for example, if your caste duty says, because you're a member of the higher caste, it's your right to rape any Dalit woman that you come across, then that's your caste duty to do that. So it's got nothing to do with ethics. It's just about, it's just about what your caste rules are about. So he saw that that's the myth that needs to be transformed. It's the deep kind of psychic story that shapes Indian society. The deep psychic forces that give rise to what form society takes and what form the individual takes as well. So Dr. Ambedkar searched for a new myth, for a new means of transforming mind and soul. And he looked at all the world's religions in depth because he thought that religion is essential to human beings. And he doesn't mean by that just taking on your inherited religion, but also questioning if religion is necessary, and if so, which one? So this was a lifetime of thought and exploration, the most educated man in India, looking through all the world's religions and thinking, well, which one can really help? And it wasn't a political decision. It was a personal exploration. He really did think religion is essential for human beings. And he says that many persons throughout the world have exhibited an unprecedented piece of courage with regard to inheritance of their religion. Many have, as a result of the influence of scientific inquiry, come to the conclusion that religion is an error which ought to be given up. There are others who, as a result of the Marxian teaching, have come to the conclusion that religion is opium which induces the poor people to submit to the domination of the rich and should be discarded. Whatever be the causes, the fact remains that people have developed an inquiring mind in respect of religion, and the question whether religion is at all worth having, and if so, which religion is worth having, are questions which are uppermost in the minds of those who dare to think about the subject. So in a way, when I read that piece from Dr. Ambedkar, which was written pretty much around the same time that he was drafting the Constitution of India, I sort of thought, well, that's us. You know, it's not just about 1940s India. It's about us. It's about who we are. Here we are also daring to think about this subject, perhaps even daring to change our religion, reflecting on whether religion is worth having and whether this religion is worth having and whether Buddhism is even a religion at all. So, yeah, Dr. Ambedkar represents the mind of the modern man or woman. He's educated and inquiring. He represents us. So what criteria did he use to inquire which religion is worth having? Well, the main thing that he talked about was what mental and moral relief does it bring to the suppressed and downtrodden? So that's quite interesting. What mental and moral relief does it bring to the suppressed and downtrodden? Because when I think about that, I think, well, is that a question that we would ask? I'm not sure it is, actually. I don't know what you would think your question would be. I think my question would be, what mental and moral relief does it bring to me? Actually, I probably didn't think at all. I probably just kind of drifted, age 17, into a Buddhist centre and thought they were quite interesting Greek people. But anyway, actually, I don't think that's true. I think I did think. I just now remember myself sitting in Sunday Mass, reading the Missal from cover to cover, asking all sorts of questions to people who aren't actually listening in Mass. That's what I realised about churches. No one's thinking, they're all thinking about what they're going to eat for their Sunday dinner. So is that the question we would ask? It's an interesting question as well for Dr. Mbeki, because he's got this burning problem which is about poverty and injustice. And he talks about mental and moral relief, not political and economic relief. And I think that was the key for him. The key was this transformation of attitude, transformation of myth, transformation of the deep psychic forces in society. So does the religion give ethical guidance and transformation of mind? Not just for the individual, but for society. Does it really change those deeper myths of society? Does it change mental attitude? Does it change the ethical guidance for everyone? And there's no prizes for guessing which religion that he chose, by the way. He ended up choosing Buddhism, which is why I'm standing up here talking about it. He decided that that kind of deep psychic force was going to come from Buddhism. And he'd spent the rest of his life dedicated to the spread of Buddhism, and in 1956 converted with 380,000 of his followers to Buddhism. Yeah, so he thought that the Dharma itself, Buddhism itself, could provide mental and moral relief to society, could change society. He said that Buddhists need to realise that the duty of a Buddhist is to serve Buddhism, not just be a good Buddhist, but serve Buddhism, because Buddhism is a service to society, and to serve Buddhism is to serve society itself. To serve Buddhism is to serve mankind, as he put it. And he was right, actually. The people who did convert to Buddhism with and after Dr. Mbeki have excelled culturally, educationally, psychologically, and spiritually. They say of themselves, the thing that Buddhism has really given them is freedom. And it's had an enormously positive effect on not only the Dalit community, but on Indian society in general. So, okay, there's India, there's Dr. Mbeki. But the reason I'm talking about Dr. Mbeki partly is because there was someone who was very, very interested in what was going on and who corresponded and met with Dr. Mbeki. And that was a young monk who lived in Kalimpong, who was Sangharakshita. And he said, it's interesting, I was listening to a talk that he gave once, and he said, actually, the most powerful feelings in his life are connected with the Dalit people. It was quite an interesting statement for him, that he was so deeply moved with the plight of the Dalit people, and also deeply moved by Dr. Mbeki and his teaching. You know, Dr. Mbeki was not an easy man, actually. Someone with that much fire, that much dedication to others, he was a real force, a very, very fiery force. And you know, Sangharakshita developed quite an interesting relationship with him. And I think that he did have a big influence on Sangharakshita's thinking. And what Sangharakshita says is the thing that Dr. Mbeki showed him was that great social changes can be brought about by spiritual means. And he set up a new Buddhist movement with that in mind. He didn't ever envisage Buddhism as an exotic hobby. It didn't envisage something that you go to and, you know, do a little bit of meditation here and you know, go to the Buddhist Center once a week. He wanted a movement that would influence society, that would bring about social change by spiritual means, that would transform the deep psychic forces, that would transform the myth of society. So looking at that, well, I was considering, well, what is our myth that needs transforming? And actually, I think it's inherently very, very difficult to look outside your own culture. It's very difficult to step outside of yourself and say, well, this is the deep-rooted myth of our society. I think I sort of have to go to India to think about it, if you see what I mean. Well, fortunately, we've got a lot of brothers and sisters in the order in India, and they often tell you what the myth of our society is. Sometimes a little bit embarrassing. But I was thinking about it, and I was thinking of all, I was trying to think of maybe there's a fairy story, maybe there's a kind of some kind of myth or legend that would sum it up. And in the end, I actually came back to the Bible. And I thought, well, I think actually, if I was to think about the myth of our society, it's summed up in Genesis. Yes, not the band, the first book of the Bible. So in the first book of the Bible, it says, and God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So I think, in a way, the central myth, and this is open to discussion because I've just sort of been thinking about it myself, the central myth is that we are like the gods over the earth and everything that lives in it. We are the highest and the rest exists for us. We have dominion and power to subdue. We have dominion over the earth and everything that lives in it. And the manifestations of this myth is that we are the centre of everything, and everything on the earth exists for our use. So if there's an animal and we want to eat it, we should, because their desire for life is irrelevant in comparison to our own dominance. And they exist for our use. And what about ripping up the earth and taking out the minerals and metals? Well, of course, if we want something from the earth, we should just take it, because it exists for us. So I'm not blaming the Bible, by the way, for this attitude. I just think, in a way, it sort of sums up, who knows what came first, the Bible or the attitude. But in a way, it sums up that attitude. And I think it gives rise to a sort of unstoppable greed. It makes human beings like a very, very spoiled child who's been given this massive playground and told it can have whatever it likes. And there's nothing to stop us because we're the highest. We are created in God's own image. So it's all for us. You know, everything is for us. And I think it also leads to sort of individualism, because it's not just all for us, it's all about us. You know, everything is about us. Everything is in relation to me and my own dominance over the world. So there's a kind of human being, each individual human being is the centre of everything, having control and dominance over everything else. And I don't know if any of you were there or have heard it, but on the international retreat recently, Vadika gave a really marvellous talk about neoliberal economics and the consumer society. And he said that neoliberal economics works on the basis that there is limitless demand. And supply just needs to kind of catch up with that. So the more the demand there is, the more supply they'll become. Actually, you know, I did do economics at A level, and I remember I probably was your absolute worst nightmare as a student doing A-level economics. And I remember sort of at that point, I remember that bit where it's, you know, well, demand is infinite. It just goes on and on. It's never any end to demand. I remember being really shocked and kind of bleak. That's such a bleak way of looking at the world, that we'll just go on and on and on and on, wanting more and more and more. And then I was told it was a good thing. It was a good thing that we have this endless demand, because by increasing demand and supply, we'll create wealth, which will create more supply and demand. So again, it's this vision that we have dominion over everything. It's all about our wants, and the world just has to meet that. And I remember really questioning that at school, actually, and the economics teacher got really fed up with me and said, look, if you want to teach this class, then you can teach it. And she underestimated my complete ability to say things with absolute confidence that I knew nothing about. So I took her at her word and I stood up in the class. I'd just been reading all these books about development economics, and I just started to make up facts. And she couldn't test it because she didn't have a book. So I'm really sorry that was a lie. But the basis was good. There was a thought there that was good. Anyway, so, you know, this vision of society, this kind of spoiled child vision of society, has problems. It has hidden costs. First of all, of course, environmental damage. Because you can't just create something out of nothing. You're taking something from somewhere. And also that the division between the rich and the poor gets wider and wider. It leads to wasted lives. That's what I was thinking. You know, it's in as supply needs to go up, people have to work more and more in meaningless, repetitive jobs. And at the top of the scale, you just get more greedy, spoiled children who are deeply dissatisfied with life. No wealth is created. It's just bargained for. It is stolen. It comes at a cost. And that cost is not something we are necessarily going to directly experience. And it also creates a kind of fragmented society, because we're alienated from the earth and we're alienated from other people. We live in this individualistic society where everything revolves around me and my mental states and my needs. It's lonely at the top, is another way of putting it. So if everything centres around me, it's deeply unsatisfying and it's lonely, because it's unsatisfying because you can't always get what you want. And even if you get it, even if you have dominion over the whole world, you're stuck with yourself and it's not enough. Human beings are far more than material possessions. You know, we have the capability of unlimited wisdom and compassion and energy. And trying to fob us off with just more stuff isn't going to really work. I don't think it's religion is the opium of the people. I think it's TV, actually. So Western Buddhism can often play into this myth. That's the interesting thing. It can often just fit neatly into that myth, the myth of consumerist society, the myth that we have dominion over everything, that we can go on. It teaches us that we can go on in this relentless game of consumerism, as long as we're mindful about it, as long as we're aware of what we're doing. And in fact, the danger of Western Buddhism is it can make us more inward-looking and alienated. We can end up just sort of not trying to challenge anything, not trying to change any of the deeper myths. We can end up in this state of apathy because we're being so mindful about ourselves and our mental state that we've forgotten to look at what's going on around us. And we can just step back. We can just step back and look at this kind of mad game and not try and change any of it because, you know, we understand that things are impermanent and non-self and, you know, inherently unsatisfactory. So we have the illusion that we can just step back from it all. That's the real danger of Western Buddhism. And it's a danger that quite an interesting modern thinker, Zizek, talked about in an article that he wrote about Western Buddhism. He says of modern Western Buddhism that instead of trying to cope with the accelerating rhythm of technological progress and social changes, One should instead let oneself go, drift along while retaining an inner distance and indifference towards the mad dance of accelerated progress. He says it enables you to fully participate in the frantic pace of the capitalist game, while sustaining the perception that you are not really in it, that you are well aware of how worthless this spectacle is, and that what really matters to you is the peace of the inner self to which you know you can always withdraw. So that's the danger of modern Buddhism. And I have to say, when I read that, I thought, oh dear, you know, maybe I do that. You know, I'm so kind of comfortable in my Welsh retreat centre, sitting on my cushions, feeling my own inner peace. Have I just completely forgotten about society and about other people? And, you know, I've got my friends around me and the people that I communicate, but have I really taken on who we really are and what's really shaping our deeper attitudes towards life? Sangha actually has a name for this attitude. He calls it pseudo-spiritual aestheticism. He says we're still doing the same things, but in a more refined, quieter, more aesthetic sort of way. So we can have as much as we like, as long as it's made out of sort of natural wood and bamboo, and is very simple and aesthetic, and Farrenball paint. I really love Farrenball paint. So there's no real lifestyle change. There's no real engagement with society. It's interesting, because actually Dr. Ambedkar made this same criticism. He actually made it of, there wasn't really Western Buddhism at that time, but he made it of the monastic Sangha that he saw in the East. And he called them the huge army of idlers, sitting on their bottoms, thinking about their own mental states. He didn't say that, actually, I was thinking. But, you know, huge army of idlers gives us enough of an impression. So are we the huge army of idlers? Yeah, let's move on. Let's talk about what we should be. So what we should be is I'm going to talk about the myth of Triratna, the myth of Buddhism, but the myth of Triratna particularly, that Sangharakshita himself identified as what the order really is, what the movement really is. And it's this myth here. So I know that quite a few of you are familiar with this image. It's the image of Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Bodhisattva means the being who is completely dedicated towards Bodhi, awakening, enlightenment. And what you notice about this particular Bodhisattva, this image, this myth, is it's bigger than one person. So it's not really a person at all, because I'm a person, you're people. You, I assume, like myself, have one head and two hands. But how many heads do we all have in this room, if we put ourselves all together? And how many hands do we all have if we all stood in a line and did that thing? Kids. It's not an image of an individual. It's not trying to be an image of any person or any one individual. It's an image of a sangha, of a people. So the first thing we notice about it is it's got 1,000 arms with 1,000 hands. And each hand, traditionally, is holding a different implement. So what this image shows is that we all bring our own qualities to help in the world. So Buddhism, as you've had a talk already on, is not just about me. It's about seeing myself as part of a wider society, part of the earth and of the world. And there's an interesting story about this. It's actually part of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. He had a kind of moment of doubt whether anyone would be able to understand the Dharma, whether he could really teach others. And he had at that moment a vision of lotuses. He saw a great lotus pond. He saw all beings were like lotuses emerging from the kind of mud of existence, trying to reach towards the light. And it said at this point that he trembled, he shook with all beings, he resonated with all beings. And I think that's the real vision of enlightenment, is it's not just one person's kind of attainment. It's a real trembling, a visceral feeling for all beings, All beings can change and grow. And in fact, this is the precise reason why Dr. Ambedkar chose Buddhism. He chose Buddhism because he said it was based in liberty, equality and fraternity. And he says he got those values not from the French Revolution, but from his master, the Buddha. He saw that Buddhism teaches a vision of society where everyone can change, everyone can develop, everybody is free to grow, everybody is free to choose their own destiny. Everybody can gain enlightenment. We're all equally like these beings growing up from the mud of existence, reaching towards the light. And he saw the Buddhist vision of society is based on metta and ethics. Everyone is part of the same brother and sisterhood. There's no one excluded from metta. There's no one excluded from ethics. Not even non-Buddhists. So you can't take metta out of Buddhism. You can't take ethics out of Buddhism. You can't apply ethics just to the Buddhists, and but we can go and rage holy war on the non-Buddhists. That's not part of Buddhism. Buddhism talks about how each people might be like a river, but they all flow into one ocean. So the vision of Buddhism is taking that into account. All beings can grow and develop. And the Sangha reaches out to help them in various different ways. And I have to say that that is quite a relief to me, because we can't do it on our own. We can't change society on our own. We're so limited. I'm so limited. Even Bhante himself, even Sangharaksha himself, said, well, you know, I'm quite limited. For example, he said, you know, I don't know much about science. We need people in the order who know much more about science. So that they can see how the Dharma relates to science. He sees that as his own limitation. And, you know, I'm not necessarily the best person to do things. I need people around me who are better at me than other things. And what a relief, because what a complete trauma that would be, to have to be the best at everything and for everyone. I couldn't possibly do that. We can't do it alone. Some people are much better at things than we are, and we need to collect together so that we can each offer those gifts to the world. But it's more than that, because the 1,000 arms are united in one body. So we need to feel that we are part of a body of people united in the same ideals. And being part of a body gives us support. But it gives us much more than that. It gives us a basis of reaching out into the world that's bigger than our own self-importance. So I was thinking about this in terms of the institutions of the order and the movement in Tri Ratna. And there's a hidden force behind the institutions. There's a hidden force behind Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And what that is team meetings. We're really fantastic at meetings in this order. We're just great at them. We just really know how to do them. I don't know if they still do it, but Sheffield Buddhist Centre team meeting always used to start with a frog song. Does it do that? Oh, you're missing out. Anyway, I won't do that now. I used to sing a song about a frog. It was good fun. Anyway, that wasn't here. Yeah, so there's this thing called team meetings behind everything. And what that is about checking out with each other what's going on for us and why we're doing what we're doing and giving each other feedback back. And Tea Ratna Loco, on a retreat, you know, we run these retreats, and sometimes you're just basically sort of doing something all day. So you're either meditating or you're meeting up with people or you're leading study, or in my case, you're trying to wrestle with the vegetable order. And it comes to 5:30, and we have our team meeting. And that team meeting is really quite special, because something goes into it which completely feeds the rest of my day. And it's not anything really obvious. It's just more like I know that I'm part of a team, and that we're all acting out of the same ideals. And I get some feedback, and I can make confessions about my behaviour, and we can talk things through with each other. And I'm not alone. And that, for me, is really personally very, very important. And I noticed in Sheffield as well that I'm really pleased to see how people want to get together. There's a natural desire to get together and work with each other from a basis of a common vision and common ideal. So there's all these little kind of groups of people living together, the community starting in various places, and ideas for right livelihoods starting to grow. Because I think people want to act from that basis, which is collective, and not just the kind of lonely warrior going striding out into the world on their own. You know, we want to act as part of a community. We want that kind of source of support and inspiration. And it's completely radical. I don't think we really realise how radical it is, because it's totally against this idea that the world exists for me, and that I'm lonely and alienated and apart from the world. It's totally against the idea that the world exists for me. And it's more about the idea that I exist for the world, and I am part of the world. The world doesn't exist for me. The world isn't just there for my use. And I think this is beautifully summed up in a poem by Sangharakshita, where he says, "Life does not belong to us. We belong to life. Life is king." So we belong to life. Life does not belong to us. That's a very, very radical vision. And actually, it's very radical in the Buddhist world, because many Buddhist groups are based, not exclusively, but many Buddhist groups are based on the idea of disciples revolving around the guru. So what you have is the teacher at the centre, and then you have a very disparate group of disciples dotted around the place. This is how a lot of modern Western Buddhism works, who meet together maybe once a year. But basically, their relationship is all about revolving around a guru. And I just don't think that's going to do it. I don't think that's going to change society. I don't think it's going to change the deeper myth of society, because people aren't working together. So I remember talking at a meeting for European Buddhists, you know, not just Tree Run, but a whole load of us. And there were all these Buddhist teachers talking together. And we were talking about, one of the teachers was talking about how she noticed that she had a lot of disciples who were psychotherapists, and she wanted them to get each other to ring each other up maybe once a month. And this was quite a radical idea. And I said, well, why don't you get them to live together and set up a psychology practice or something, a therapy practice, and do it together? And it was like, that was a completely different idea. Completely different. And I think, actually, that's what we need. We need to do things together. We need to work together if we're going to transform society. Yeah. So it's a vision of Sangha, 1,000-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara, is a vision of society, the society acting for the benefit of the world. And at the heart is the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel, which is an image for the bodhicitta, the heart or mind that is totally dedicated towards enlightenment. And I think this is also another radical idea, because what it's saying is it's a myth that at the heart of which is real transformation of mind and soul that transcends the individual. So the bodhicitta is a kind of force for goodness, feeling yourself to be part of a force for goodness in the world that transcends the individual. It's sometimes called like an energy working through the world for the benefit of the world. And it's the real transformation. It's the real transformation, because instead of looking inward towards our own mental states and revolving around our own sort of self-clinging, we start to look outwards to the world around us. So at the heart of Avalokiteshvara is real practice, inspiration and vision, a force that transcends the individual. And this is open to everyone, no matter what sex, no matter what background, no matter what sexual orientation, no matter what educational standard, no matter what country you're living in, no matter whether you can read or write. This is open to everyone. It's real inner transformation and deep inspiration and vision. So this is the kind of radical myth. This is the myth, in a way, that we're offering to the world. The myth of Sangha. The story of Sangha. The story of the transformation of mind and soul. Not only our own mind and soul, but the mind and soul of society itself. And what can we learn from this? Well, I think the first thing that we can learn from this is that we can have confidence that not only we ourselves can have an effect, but Buddhism itself is a force for goodness in the world. You know, we tend in our society to separate religion from social action, religion from politics, because religion is a private affair. It's a bit of a dirty word. You don't talk about it in polite society. You know, you don't talk about it in your family or your friends or your colleagues. You just keep it as this kind of personal interest. Well, in India, it's not like that at all. You know, it's very much social transformation is very much bound up with inner transformation. And Buddhism itself is seen as a social force for good in society. So going back to Dr. Ambedkar, to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. I think we could really reflect on that, whether we think that's true. And really take on that the transformation of self requires the transformation of society. And that the transformation of society requires the transformation of self. Because otherwise you can get all the economic and political freedom you like, but you'll still have the same society because people themselves won't have changed. You'll still, for example, enforce the caste system, even if you've got the best constitution in the world. And also, unless we develop ourselves, we cannot but blunder around trying to save others in the dark, making more problems than we've solved. So in order for us to change, we need a change in society. But in order for society to change, we need a change in ourselves. We need to hold the Chintamani to our hearts. And the other thing that we could take from this is that we could support what a Sangha calls, and I do love this expression, vigorous initiatives in wholesome directions. You know, don't just see our Bowen Buddhist practice as our own sort of private affair on our cushions about, you know, my mental state, but really support vigorous initiatives in wholesome directions. You know, and so much, there's so much we could do in society, and in a way we can get a bit overwhelmed by that. You know, what am I meant to do? When am I meant to save society? Is that kind of before work or after work? Or should I do it when I put the kids to bed? Or, you know, or the weekend? When do I do that, you know, in my busy life? When do I do that? Well, Bhante's point is that the Bodhisattva is a Sangha. It's not an individual. It's not up to us to do it all on our own. That's not the point. The point is about the overall revolution of consciousness, not about who does it. So whenever there's a vigorous initiative, your own or another person's, support it, either with time or money or practical help. And the third thing I wanted to say, which, you know, given that I work at a retreat centre that focuses on the ordination training, is get ordained. You know, if you're not already. Or at least join in. At least join in with the Sangha. We can't do it alone. But if we do it together, something might really happen. Something will arise that's greater than the sum of its parts. So I'm just going to end with a letter that Dr. Ambedkar actually wrote to Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita wrote a very appreciative letter to Dr. Ambedkar. And Dr. Ambedkar wrote a rather fiery response. So he said, "Great responsibility lies on the shoulders of the bhikkhus." So we could say on the shoulders of the Sangha. "If this attempt at the revival of Buddhism is to be a success, they must be more active than they have been. They must come out of their shell and be in the first rank of the fighting forces." So the first rank of the fighting forces. And at the time when he wrote this letter, Sangharakshita was living in Kalimpong, and he'd set up the Young Men's Buddhist Association. And Dr. Ambedkar says, "I'm glad that you have started the YMBA at Kalimpong. You should be more active than that." And I always think about that little last sentence, "You should be more active." It's great, Vajratara, what you're doing. Really fantastic. Yeah. You should be more active than that. Well, maybe we should all be more active to that. You know, Buddhism is very, very new in the West. Tri Ratna is very new in the West. Tri Ratna is very new in Sheffield. And maybe we need to think bigger, think more actively. You know, I've come across the idea in modern Western Buddhism that people see Buddhism as about being good people, good Buddhists in their neighbourhood. And the kind of vision is that you're a good person in your kind of work and your home life, and then you're good to the people around you, and you know, you're good to the greengrocer or whatever, and then that greengrocer feels happier, and then they're better to other people, and the people at school and the people at college and people in your workplace are all kind of better to each other, which is great. It's a really, really good start. But I think actually we can think much more radically than that. We could think about working on our own practice to transform our own psychic forces, our own myth. We could think about creating a sangha to transform each other's psychic forces, working together to transform the myth of society. We could think much more radically. We could think about transforming the myth of society, which really means giving people a new myth, the myth of the Dharma itself, the myth of enlightenment, that confidence that everybody can gain enlightenment. We could give them the myth of the Bodhisattva. So what I thought we could talk about in our groups is, you know, think bigger. So think, what would you like Sheffield Buddhist Centre to be in 10 years' time? So what will Sheffield Buddhist Centre be like in 10 years' time? Just think about, you know, make it up. You know, no one's going to kind of write it down and hold you to it. Just think about what it could be like and what you'd like Sheffield Buddhist Centre to do in 10 years' time. In Sheffield, how could we transform Sheffield? What force could we be in society?